we start on the highest of high notes as we welcome back to the program from Defector.com and the Distraction Podcast, our friend David Roth, to make sense of it all. Hello, David.
Hey, how are you? This is a heavy lift, but I'm going to do my best.
If there's a man alive who can do it, it's you.
Well, that is flattering. As long as you don't think about what it all represents, it's extremely flattering.
That's how I live my life. I try never to think about what it all represents.
Are you really going to be backing off the Tweets of the Day segment, or are you going to stay with it?
Well, what we're going to do is we're going to incorporate wit and wisdom from other social media sites. So, yes, we'll take some things from Twitter once in a while, because like you're there, so there's always good content. But we'll borrow some stuff from Post, and then we'll even look. I'm one of the 11 people on Mastodon, so maybe I'll find something good there too. Who knows? I may go to Tinder and see what I can find.
I'd clear that with your family first, but the definitely might as well cast a wide net. My friend Maria is into Mastodon and had a post today, the headline of which is, "It's not that hard to use," with an exclamation point. So she clearly thinks that Mastodon is usable. I had some initial troubles getting myself signed up for it, and then at some point was like, I'll just stay on the Titanic until it sinks and I drown.
Yeah, and I guess that's my attitude. First, I was going to leave when Trump came back on, but I was there when he was on before. Who cares? And there are still a lot of people I like there, but so... You seem to have this skill of getting inside the head of twisted rich people. So I ask you this, David Roth, what is Elon Musk thinking?
He's a different case than... I got credit from nice people like you for the, one insight that I had into Trump. Elon seems kind of sadder. Like, I think he's just kind of like a pretty whack human being, like just kind of like a boring, needy guy with a bad sense of humor. And that's sort of frustrating, because it's not like you couldn't say that about Trump either, but at least Trump was like a real high quality poster for a lot of his time on Twitter. He changed the way that people think and post, not necessarily for the better, but he did do it. Whereas Elon is just one of those guys that uses the like cry laughing emoji three times per post. it's very poor form. He hasn't ever put a tweet up that was anything but the most like embarrassing, comments under a news article on Facebook grade insight. And I don't think that like all rich people, he's surrounded by, weird supplicants and people trying to sort of, in one way or another, manipulate him to their advantage. Sometimes that's different than supplicants, because in this case, some of them are like reactionary influencers that know that if they say, you're not doing what you said, he will say right away, Mr. at cat turd two, sir, like, I'll fix this to make him one way you want it. All of which is pretty pathetic. Like, when you're sucking up to, bloggers with mood disorders from conservative websites, and you've got billions of dollars, I think you need to take a long look at yourself.
Yeah, it's very strange, and strange to watch what's happening there. Now, I haven't seen this in my feed, but Carrie has noticed that he keeps getting recommendations to follow and then tweets from all of these crazy right-wing, well, many of those bloggers that you talked about, and a lot of it's because... maybe people that he follows for some of that Tweet of the Day content may have liked something that, God forbid, Dave Portnoy tweeted, and all of a sudden, there he is, El Presidente is in Carrie's feed.
Yeah, I had a similar experience, Carrie. You have to change the settings on it if you're using it on your... I guess it's true if you're doing it on your phone, too, but I use it for, desktop a lot of the time, and there's two different settings, and one of which is what they call, it's like top tweets. And then one of them is more like chronological order of people you follow. And top tweets became unusable maybe 3 or 4 days ago this week. And I switched away from it and haven't switched back. But it was the exact same thing where I had to scroll a great long ways to find. And this was like baseball things were happening, I wasn't looking for especially high quality content. I was like, wow, did the Mets really sign Justin Verlander? And all it was giving me instead were, people being like, like libertarian influencers that were sort of, you know, like electric cars are actually like pretty much the same thing as communism. Follow me for more insights like this. And it was just the most trash, like low effort stuff. And I feel like in a version of Twitter where it's working, those would have been just commercials. Like that would have been an ad for not one weird guy's Bitcoin newsletter, but for like Nissan. But Nissan wants nothing to do with this. No
right.
real advertiser wants anything to do with the version of Twitter that we've got. And so, like, maybe you'll get an NFL highlight, but a lot of it is exactly that. And then it's stuff that, you know, people that you follow, and so, and those tweets seem, you know, more or less chosen at random. Not all of those were bad, but again, I was just trying to find out the terms of the Verlander deal, you know? Like, I didn't need somebody's insight on the great global warming hoax. Like, I'm just like, where does this... That seems like kind of a decent annual value for a 2-year commitment. Anyway, it seems like it's going great. Obviously, Elon's having fun, crawling before Elton John and asking about what types of misinformation he was mad about. It's pretty much, I mean, it says quite a bit. We've talked about Twitter on this show for many years. I think it's always been clear that there's something a little bit embarrassing about doing that because it's such a stupid website and it's making all of us stupider. And I don't know that I've ever seen it dumber than it is right now.
David Roth with us here on Downtown. Well, big news in the political world today. Kyrsten Sinema announcing that she is no longer a Democrat. As I said earlier today, I would also like to announce I am no longer in the NBA.
Yeah, gosh, I mean, for her, I saw people trying to sort of find a way that this was actually like a brilliant play on her part. You know, that she makes herself a power player, there's no longer 51 Democratic seats in the Senate. And I think it's important to remember where Kyrsten Sinema is concerned that she has no constituency at all.
Right, right.
Nobody, so she could do whatever she wants. Like, she could declare herself like a rhinoceros. Everybody'd be like, that is awesome. Where did you get those glasses? And then they would go back to ignoring her. She doesn't do anything. And in terms of, you know, if she sort of sees herself as like a version of Joe Lieberman that wears more exciting prints, then I guess that's like... Like, it's grandiose, I guess, but it doesn't really seem like anything to aspire to. She also, like, and this is the other bit where, you know, I've seen sort of people speculating about what this is going to mean. She runs as an independent in Arizona, then she splits the vote with the Democrat, and that hands things to the Republican, and this is all terrible. And I think that that really overestimates how many people in Arizona would vote for her under any circumstances. Her approval rating across all parties in that state is 17%. So, you know, if all of those people voted for her instead of somebody that was going to get elected, I guess that would be bad. I also think that, you know, 20% for me has always been like the baseline number of Americans that will believe anything. That, you know, 20% of people at least think, you know, the moon landing was fake. The earth might be flat. I don't know. It needs more study. The fact that she can't get to moon landing was fake numbers in the state that she currently represents in the United States Senate, to me says that this is a pay no mind situation.
He's obviously not a great human being. But
no.
Should we feel
happy dresser though?
Well, yeah. Should we feel sad at all though, or feel anything for Herschel Walker after this whole debacle?
Oh, I thought you were talking about Kyrsten Sinema.
Well, her
yes. I don't think so. I feel like what I feel bad about with Walker is that it seems like he got used up by a sport that uses people up and then has been getting used nonstop ever since. I read, I guess I recommend it. It's very written. Jeremy Collins wrote a feature about him for Esquire that you can find on their website that I read. And it sort of followed in a way that I had always been kind of curious about, just how much Walker meant to people of a certain generation as a football player in Georgia, which is not something, I'm not from Georgia, you know, I didn't know. I knew him as a good NFL player, but one with a short career, and, you know, in the end, not a Hall of Fame career, like, nothing like the sort of god that he was at Georgia. And I think that people have been getting over on him, and he himself has also had this sort of weird, even by football player standards, thirst for attention and recognition that hasn't done him any favors. But I didn't know a lot of the stuff you know about he said that he had multiple personality disorder and that it was cured through doctor. And I didn't know this until I read the Esquire article. The doctor that supposedly cured him is not a medical doctor.
I thought you were going to say it was Ronnie Jackson.
No, I mean, basically, like, Ronnie Jackson, at the very least, like, could probably pronounce the name of most of the powerful antipsychotics that are out there. This guy was a dude who, he's like a demonologist.
Oh, good.
And so
his
belief was that he was able to get Herschel's multiple personalities under control by exercising them one by one. Herschel believed this too. That's what his book is about, you know, where he talks about sort of conquering this. That guy wrote the foreword to it. So it just seems like, even in this case, you can't necessarily let the guy off the hook. Like, he chose to run a pretty ugly campaign on some pretty ugly policies that, you know, had he been elected, you know, I have no doubt that he would have worked his hardest, or at the very least voted accordingly while periodically going on TV to make a lot of people's lives harder just on principle, because that's the platform of that party at this point. What I don't get is sort of like what was in it for him. And that's the part where you sort of feel sad about it. Like, I don't think that this was an ennobling experience for him. And I do feel like it's hard to escape the sense that he was used by some people who were, you know, much more cynical than him. It's just, you know, I don't have to like any of them, and I won't feel bad for any of them when they're out of power. You know, it's just tougher because I do remember Herschel being cool, whereas, like, there's not a point in time where I, you know, there's no golden age of Ted Cruz for me. I never cheered for, like, even, you know, Herschel Walker, he was a giant at the very end of his career returning kicks. Like, I guess if, like, Lindsey Graham had had a similar experience with the Giants, I would have a softer spot for him, but he didn't. He was in the Navy at the time.
What about this whole Brittany Griner situation? So let me see if I have this right. Before her release, the right was screaming that that Joe Biden was leaving her to rot in a Russian penal colony. Now she's out, and how dare you bring back somebody like her who kneels, oh my God, who kneels during the national anthem when we left a proud Marine behind. Okay, a proud Marine who got convicted of crimes and was dishonorably discharged and was arrested by the Russians because he was a, you know, soldier for hire, a mercenary, but still, he was a Marine once.
That part of it is incredible. To see all of these posts that are, you know, like, never leave a Marine behind, and then you see the asterisk next to the Marine part, and then you read the text next to the asterisk, and it's two paragraphs long, is really remarkable to me. I guess this is the part where I've spent some time trying to figure this out. I haven't really gotten my head around how to write about it, because it's kind of grim, and it's also not very complicated. I think the thing for the people that are making this point, where, you know, they're screeching about the fact that Brittany Griner is in a penal colony, and then they're screeching about the fact that she's not, and they just sort of turn their attention to whoever else is still there. Those people just want to be upset.
Yes.
And I know that that is kind of, as stereotypes go, that is the one that generally gets appended to liberals, and I think it's not entirely unfair there either, but in this case, it feels like, in the same way that Fox News sort of leads that entire political project around at this point, it's the motivation for Fox in acting like that is to keep people around through the commercial break. If you're a normal person and you are constantly looking for something to keep you mad because otherwise you're going to get bored and change the channel, then that's a choice that you're making. It's not a programming decision made according to, like, best practices and fine-grained study of ratings. That's just you choosing to give yourself a mood disorder. And that seems really unwise to me.
All right, let's talk about lighter subjects here. And let's talk about that Verlander deal and the Mets. Overall, it seems like a pretty good situation there for a team that had a great season. Postseason didn't go so well, but now building for another run this coming year.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's not 100% what I wanted, you know, just because I loved watching Jacob deGrom and I was sad to watch him go. It seems very important to him to live on a ranch that is located in a state with a certain kind of tax environment, and that's fine. You know, like, we can't do that for him up here. But the way that the Mets have made moves and the way that they've spent money. I think in general, the way that most of baseball, or at least the teams that spend money, the way that they have spent money this offseason, to me is kind of, it's refreshing in the sense that it is a reminder that it didn't have to be the way that it's been for the last, you know, 6 or 8 years in terms of that environment, that treating the luxury tax thresholds as if they were actual salary caps became something that was so widely agreed upon that I think even if you knew that they weren't, even if you knew that the tax penalties were, in a lot of cases, not even especially harsh, when every team is doing it, you start to accept it as reality. And the fact of the matter is Steve Cohen has billions of dollars. He likes to play fantasy baseball in real life. And there's no reason why he couldn't do this if he wanted to. There's no reason why any owner could. And so to see some of the criticisms, especially of the Padres for having given away some of these deals, the Phillies have also done a lot of these decade-plus contracts. There's arguments pro and con. You know, obviously we don't know what Trey Turner or Xander Bogaerts or Bryce Harper or anybody's going to be like in 10 years. And the Mets have avoided giving away super long contracts like that. Brandon Nimmo's is long, but not crazy long like that. In all of those cases, I just think it comes back to it's not your money, and no one knows where we're going to be in 11 years. You know?
So
if you can accept it as something more like an entertainment product and less like a business that you have some sort of silent partnership in, I think you'll have more fun. That's what I'm trying to do. There's a part of me, I know the Mets can't just like keep doing this, but until they get, their vision is to be like the Dodgers. I think a lot of teams want that, where you have high-priced elite talent at the major league level, and then this constant pressure from below of players that you're developing, signing internationally, whatever. The Mets don't have that yet. They have a couple players that are more or less ready. No one knows how good they're going to be, and then there's guys further down. And so until they do the hard part of the becoming the Dodgers East process, they have to do the spending like the Dodgers part. And as long as they're doing that, I guess I can't really complain. I can't complain about the fact that three of the five teams in the National League that are even trying are all in the same division.
Yeah.
I don't love that, but...
Well, there is no joy here in Mudville as Mighty Heim has struck out. You lose Bogaerts. Yes, it was a big, ridiculous contract, but he was a face of the franchise, a loyal guy that everybody loved and didn't really care that his numbers had declined the last couple of years. And then went out and spent $90 million on a guy who's never played in the major leagues and signed two mid-30s relievers. Gosh, what could go wrong?
Yeah, it's tough, too, because I feel like the, I want to say it's Matsutaka, the outfielder. I've seen a lot of spread on the coverage of what type of player he is or might be. I think the main issue that people seem to have is that he's not a center fielder. I think he's probably going to be. But with all of this, to see how much he missed on the Bogaerts contract by, it might be that the Padres wind up regretting that deal. But if they regret it, it's going to be in 8 years, and they're going to have... You know, they'll be stuck with 3 years left on it, but they'll have had 8 years of this wonderful player playing in the middle of their infield or DHing or whatever. And I feel like this is the thing with Bloom that I don't really get about what they've tried to do. Like, obviously, he got a mandate from ownership about delayering the most expensive players. And I understand, I mean, that's a crappy part of the job. Presumably, he knew that when he was taking it. I don't really think that they have a whole lot to show for having moved Mookie Betts and having lost Betts and Xander Bogaerts and even Benintendi. That the players that they added, I guess, like Verdugo is above average major leaguer, like an average major leaguer at this point.
Right.
The rest of it, I just don't see it. And you can't miss on stuff like that. Like, especially if you're not going to be, I mean, this is, again, the other part of it, like we were saying about the Mets and the Dodgers, that if you're not developing players rapidly enough to replace the stars that you're letting go, then you have to be scouting well enough to win those deals. You don't win a trade where you send away Mookie Betts, but you have to be scouting well enough to not look at it 2 or 3 years down the line and be like, wow, we got one major leaguer out of this.
Yeah, meanwhile, Dave Dombrowski laughing all the way to the World Series, signing Turner, spending money like there's no tomorrow. And I wonder if with Bloom, because his mission in Tampa Bay was to find all of the bargains and had no money to spend. Does he just not understand what to do with the level of money that he can spend in comparison?
I wonder about that, because I feel like the moves that he's made in terms of signing players generally haven't been that bad. They've just been very, very cautious. And that's the stuff where, I mean, if you look at Enrique Hernandez, they signed Carl Schwarber to that one-year deal. Like, those worked out. You know, it just was the sort of thing where, why are you signing, like, marginal sort of fill-in guys for 1 or 2 years if you're really going for it? And if you're not going for it, then, you know, they didn't go full raise either. And so it's been in this kind of uncomfortable middle space where it kind of feels like they were trying to be respectable, like they were trying to win, like, 87 games. And that's not, first of all, you're still in the American League East, so it's still super hard. And that's not necessarily going to get you anywhere. Like, even in this case, like, with the expanded playoffs, that all that does is get you a ticket. You know, it gets you 3 games. And I think that one way or another, the fact that they didn't sort of try harder on one of the two paths that were available to them, I think is the part that is most damning. Because if you look at what, to go like the Rays route, you kind of need the Rays player development and scouting.
Yes.
Because that's the thing that makes them what they are. Like, the being cheap part is just, like, it's a tick. It's what the owner wants, and that isn't in any way, like, helpful to them. It's just, it puts the pressure more on the other parts of it. But because they're so good at developing specific type of players, identifying types of players that are freely available as free agents, they're kind of always in it. You know, they always have new stuff coming, and they can afford to sort of spin guys off or let them walk or whatever. But there's no real virtue in that. That doesn't make it more efficient for anyone but the owner. And so if you're not developing players at that pace, then you're just kind of shuffling the deck chairs in a very strategic fashion, you know, as the waterline rises.
Yeah, and I don't think he understands that the Boston, I think, like New York, like Chicago, like Los Angeles, is a star-driven market. And people will maybe even tolerate a little bit of mediocrity if you've at least got some stars that will make it worth shelling out $150 for a ticket for a couple of people and a hot dog and a beer.
Right. I mean, this is the part of it where I think you can lose focus if you are too far on that, like, sort of NBA hyper-efficiency side of things. It's an entertainment product. You know, like, tickets are not how teams make most of their money now, like television is. But in all of those, you still are competing with all of these other things that you could be doing with your time. And you have to give people a reason to watch. And I think in this case, even if they were to bag 2 seasons and ask their fans to, you know, follow the farm club, like, the Major League product not going to be good for a while, I think people would be really mad about that. They would deserve it. But fans find a way, you know, like, you see Orioles fans who are, you know, following the AA team much more closely than the big league. Mm. And that, I can't imagine that that's, like, something that makes you feel especially good about yourself, but I can see how you get there. In this case, if you're putting a middling product on the field and all that you can really say to the fans is, you know, we've maintained flexibility under the luxury tax. We've got, you know, they had done stuff like that in the past. There was a post that they did on Twitter that they wound up deleting after one of the, maybe it was even the Betts trade, that was basically, you know, crediting themselves for maintaining flexibility in their payroll and stuff. And that's insulting. To me, that's, you know, your boss in an email after he lays you off, sending a follow-up to talk about how much profit the company made that quarter. Yeah. Like, that's
right. Don't put that. Don't put that in your season ticket brochure.
Right. And so I think that you have to, especially with, you know, fans, like, we know what Red Sox fans are willing to put up with. Not to be rude, you know, that, like, it was a long time where people were still going to games, people still cared about the team, and they weren't going anywhere. And I don't think that anybody got spoiled by the fact that they were as good as they were for, you know, a decade and a half. Like, they waited for that. But I think that one way or another, you have to show people that you're trying, and it has to be legible what you're trying for. you know, it can't just be this sort of thing where, you know, we're opening a competitive window 3 years down the road and we're making decisions that are, you know, pointing us in that direction. If you can say that convincingly, maybe some people will go along with you. But one way or another, you need to show them something.
David Roth, Defector.com, the Distraction Podcast. David, great talking with you as always. Well, I'm just looking, as I'm talking to you, I'm go back to that tweet, Carrie. I'm reading this tweet. Well, what a way to end. This is our world. A woman, I don't know her, Kathy Arreu, a former Fox News regular. Oh, scroll down, Carrie. Right there. A former Fox News regular dubbed the Liberal Sherpa was arrested in Miami today for allegedly kidnapping and financially extorting her mother. Well, ain't that America?
You know what her role was? I read about this. She was like a pro wrestling character. So she would go on Tucker Carlson's show and be like, children should be able to marry animals. And then he would make his Tucker Carlson faces for a while.
Oh, God.
That was her role. So not only do you get that paycheck for demeaning yourself on TV, then you go ahead and try to do multi-level marketing to your aging parents. What a way to be.
Fantastic. Well, there we go. On that note, thank you, Mr. Roth, for joining us as always. Hope you have a wonderful holiday season, and we'll see you in the new year and figure it all out again.
Right on. Thanks, man. Have a good one.
Thanks, David. Bye. David Roth with us in downtown.